have a glow. You have a glow to you today.
Yeah. Well, might also be because we have a great interview today. Hello and welcome to Talking Too Loud with Chris Savage. I'm your host, Chris Savage. I'm joined by the one and only podcast producer extraordinaire, Sylvie Lubow. Sylvie, how are we?
Pretty good.
That's great. Well, we have a great interview today with Megan Keeney Anderson. Megan Keeney Anderson is in charge of product marketing and comms for Watershed, their sustainability platform, helping companies understand their carbon impact, get under control, measure it, improve it, all that kind of stuff. She used to be at HubSpot. She's been on some of our mini episodes on Talking Too Loud, and she is a great guest. So I'm very, very excited for this episode, getting into product marketing, positioning, storytelling, how to market something new, finding the things that connect, all that good stuff. So we have a great interview coming up very shortly.
We definitely do.
We sure do. Thanks for the affirmation.
You are correct, sir.
But of course, this is Talking Too Loud, so it'd be crazy for us not to start the show by asking the question, Sylvie, what's got you talking too loud today?
Okay. Today, I'm talking too loud about 90s thrillers. I've been on a bit of a 90s thrillers bender.
Okay.
I don't know. Thriller, maybe thriller's wrong. Suspense. So I'm talking like The Client. Did you ever see The Client?
I've never seen it.
What? Sorry. I'm outraged. You've never seen it?
I don't think so.
Brad Renfro, Susan Sarandon, Tommy Lee Jones. Oh my God.
I mean, I know who some of those actors are.
Okay, you have to see it.
Really?
It's really good.
Is it? Is it like as good as The Fugitive?
I knew you were going to ask, is it as good as... It's not as good as The Fugitive, but it's high up there.
But would you consider The Fugitive to be a 90s thriller?
Yes. That's okay. Like A Few Good Men I put in this
camp. Those are great. Yeah.
But this is like from this canon.
Okay. I've never seen it.
You must watch it.
Wow.
And then we have to talk too loud about it in the future because I will want to know what you think.
Well, I can't wait. That sounds great. I'm always looking
really
for a great wreck.
Kids witness a murder.
Oh boy.
And then
there's a client.
They are the client. From a lawyer.
Okay.
But somebody's after them. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Oh, very exciting. Very thrilling. Great pitch.
It's so thrilling.
That's what we're here to do is pitch 90s movies to you all. Because we know you want the hits.
What has you talking too loud?
I think I'm going to go with, I'm doing a lot of zone one, zone two runs these days.
What's zone one? What's zone two?
It's like heart rate zones. So like lower zones, your heart rate is lower. Higher zones, your heart rate is higher. But your body uses different fuel for energy when you're like, if you're an all out sprint, your body's using carbs like blood sugar, basically. And if you're at a like much lower pace and your heart rate is a lot lower, you can use like fat for energy. And you want your body to be able to use both. You want to be able to use.
Are you doing zone one and two in the same run?
Yeah,
like that's you're like going about from one to two.
Yeah, just in that range basically. I started doing them maybe like 2 months ago. These like slower runs. And for me to be in zone two, it was like, I'm running like a 15-minute mile. You know, it's like so slow. Like I'm running, I'm stopping and walking. I'm running, I'm stopping and walking. And it's very frustrating because like to get the benefit of this, all of this is supposed to help with VO2 max. It's supposed to help performance and things. You get it. And it's just so hard to do because it feels so boring because you're just going so slow. It's almost like, did I just spend an hour doing this? Like,
yeah.
And the other thing about zone two is that your body doesn't build, it can clear the lactic acid that gets built up by your muscles. So you can basically do it indefinitely. And the cool thing is that it's been like 2 months and I did one this morning and I'm really starting to notice a difference.
Oh, really?
And yeah, where like my pace is a lot faster, even though my heart rate is the same.
That's interesting.
And I love progress. I love measuring things.
You do.
But it's been interesting because I've tried this a few times the last couple of years and could never stick with it consistently to actually see the improvement. I was like, this morning, I was like, wow, look at this. Like the pace is clearly faster. I'm feeling really good. And I came out, it was like, it did it. It was amazing.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, so I think that's, I'm talking too loud about progress.
You have a glow. You have a glow to you today.
Well, I might also be because we have a great interview today with Megan Keeney Anderson. So I'm jazzed. I'm excited. And let's just, you know what? Let's just jump into the interview right now. Megan, so good to see you. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to see you too.
This is fun. Last time we chatted was like a shorter episode in person, so a little bit different today. We're going to do the whole thing, the real deal. And I can't wait to hear what's going on in your world. I know a lot has changed since we last chatted. Yeah. But first, I have to ask you, you know, what's got you talking too loud today?
Yeah, well, okay. So one of the things that has changed is I've recently defected, I guess, from the AI space to move into climate tech. And, you know, it's interesting when you get into a new industry that you're unfamiliar with, it's kind of like a little bit like moving to a new city and you're trying to, you know, understand an entirely new language and meet a new set of characters and like find your space in it.
Yeah.
And I think like historically I've always kind of like been hesitant to like look climate change like right in the eye because it scared the f*** out of me. Like it was really daunting and it felt big and it felt like we'd already lost, right? And I think the thing that I'm obsessed with right now, like I thought when I got into this industry, it would be a continuation of that, like, you know, doom and gloom and fear and guilt. And I was like, I am signing myself up for like badness all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the doomsday clock in New York doesn't help, right? And I think like, you know, I think climate marketing kind of had to start that way because people weren't paying attention. And I think they had to like jump scare them to get them to pay attention. But like what I'm obsessed with right now that I've found as I've gotten into the space is like, the space is now full of these like pragmatic optimists. In a way that didn't exist, I don't think, a few years back, where these people who are like, actually, this is solvable, right? Like, we can do this, and it's hard, but it's not that complicated anymore. And so, like, there's this woman named Dr. Ayanna Johnson, who she's got a book coming out in September called What If We Get It Right? She's a marine biologist. She's got a podcast on this topic. And, like, her tenor, the way that she talks about this work, I'm obsessed with. And there's more than just her. There's like even like John Jor, who's from Kleiner Perkins. He's an investor in Watershed. He wrote a book called Speed and Scale that is about like, how do you take this enormous problem and bring it down to a place where the answer can be written like on a napkin, right? And so like, I think once I see a couple of like little like people here and there that are talking about a problem differently, I get really, really fixated on that. And so my team hears me talk about pragmatic optimism a lot. My family hears me talk about like, oh, that's an example of like, this is a really hard thing that we can do. And it's not this doe-eyed, idealistic, you know, let's hope our way to the solution. It's like, no, like, let's break down this problem into the component parts and figure out how to solve it. And I think that's a really powerful like marketing tenor too, because I'd like to see this work shift from fear to pragmatism, right? I think the time's come for that.
Can you, for people who don't know, can you tell us like what is Watershed? Let's start there.
Yeah, sure. So Watershed's a sustainability platform that helps these like big global brands, you know, like Sweetgreen and Walmart and major financial companies track their carbon, their footprint, and make a plan for reduction. And so most of these companies are tracking for the purposes of compliance. There's been a lot more regulations that have rolled out that require you to share the impact that you're having on the environment. But a lot of them are also tracking it because what can get managed and measured can get reduced, right?
Yeah.
And you can find efficiencies in your business outside of just like the do-gooderism of trying to help the environment out of that work, right? So there's real like economic reasons to try to drive it. So we offer a platform that helps you measure it and helps you kind of make those plans for reductions, because it's really, really messy, right? Like right now, climate data is unlike other performance data in that it's built on a lot of assumptions. It's built on like, it's a blend of your business data and things like emissions factors for that, you know, screw that went into the microphone that you're holding, right? Yeah. And so there's just a ton of transformation that has to happen to the underlying data to make it something you could use. And so that's what Watershed does.
Obviously, you were in the SaaS space for a very long time and saw it like evolve and change and, you know, saw marketing change. And I think it's interesting as you jump into this space and you see like a big, you know, potential messaging change and really overall marketing approach change. Like, talk about what that experience is like. Like, why do you think this shift in pragmatism and optimism is happening? Why now?
Yeah. I've always been a big believer in like, find the problem and that lays out everything else that you need about your marketing strategy. Figure out like, what's the enemy? What are you taking down? What's the problem you're trying to solve? And that will sort of define the rest of your marketing strategy. And I think that that part is the same. And I think that, yeah, you know, the reason why I think it's time for like this, not just Watershed, but like climate tech as a whole to shift its tone and to shift its like messaging is because messaging on fear will get people's attention, but it will also paralyze them. And if you can make that shift and you can demystify a problem and make it simpler to understand, say, you know, this thing that is big and hairy and confusing and uses language you don't know, how do we make that simpler for you so you can put your arms around it and then we can move forward on it? Like that, I think, is the drive and the necessity of making that shift from like fear to pragmatism. And so that's driving a lot of the way I'm thinking about, like, it's the same old stuff. It's like, you've got something complicated, break it down into its component parts and make it simple for people to understand. Yeah. My Aunt Patty should be able to understand this, even if she's not the target market.
Let's go. I want to go further here because I feel like this is like, this is really interesting to anybody who's trying to market anything, basically. It's like, how do you break down the pieces? And it's just like, you're talking about a bigger shift that's happening. But what, like, even what you just said, like, shouldn't we only just like think about personas? Like, why is simple good? Like, why should we make stuff simple? Why should we break it down that way? Like, what if your Aunt Patty isn't going to be the customer?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's I love that kind of delineation of it. You always want to like market to your core buyer. Like, you know, our core buyer is the chief sustainability officer, the chief ESG officer. Sometimes either your CFO or your controller. It's interesting because sustainability is like shifting into the finance office. So our persona is changing. Yeah. But the reason why you want to make it as simple as possible is because those people that you are messaging to, they then have to go message this to the rest of their company. And so you need to give them the tools to take something that they maybe understand at a more complex level and go deliver it to the rest of the company. The same thing was true, you know, in AI when I was at Jasper. You know, we were marketing to the CMO, but we knew that the rest of the company was going to have like a lot of fear, a lot of trepidation on one end, and on the other end, a lot of like unbridled enthusiasm about AI. And we needed to give them a way to talk about what is the right way to bring this into our company. So I think simplicity always matters. Even like if you think it's, you've gone too far, you haven't gone far enough in terms of bringing it back to like the core essence of like before, after, good, bad, you know, like problem solution, you know, making it real. Every company that I admire in marketing, every company that I've worked at that has done, you know, grappled with this, like they all go back to sort of the same mechanisms of like helping people find their space in a story and, you know, speaking in frameworks like that because they work. And then you can build up all of the complexity on top of that.
I just think it's really interesting because I think it's a classic trap to fall into is like you see your customers' complex, very complex needs, and they probably are complex problem that you're solving. And also if they're senior, you think they're dealing with complex, just decision making all the time. And so then people don't actually go to the simplest stuff. They go to like complex stuff, thinking that's what somebody wants to hear. And I just think your example here and drawing that together of like, it's not just about the buyer. Like, it's about the people around the buyer. It's about the organization understanding why you're making the decision. It's just very easy to forget. And when you forget it, you don't do good marketing, right? Like, you don't do marketing that stands out.
Okay,
I also want to talk about a shift that we've been talking about a little bit on the show. Certainly something we're talking about a lot at Wistia, which is this shift in like the data we have versus the data we don't have. So 15 years ago, online marketing, you basically had perfect data. Like, I put an ad out and I saw this is the terms and this is who clicked it and this is how they acted. And so, you know, you could optimize like really well. And we're getting less and less data on like the higher we go up in the funnel, basically. Like, we can see we're putting stuff out of the world, but it's harder to track it. And then once they hit our website or once they sign up, we actually have perfect data again.
Yeah.
How do you think about this challenge and opportunity? Like, what do you think teams should be doing to stand out? Like, how should they incentivize that? What types of people should they put on it? How do you think about this challenge between, you know, really going from having very little data at the top to having much more data once someone's like actually, you know, touching, signing up like in your product?
Yeah. And it's a bit funny to see this like full swing happen, because when I came into marketing, it was like, but what gets measured gets done, which means like, if we cannot measure it, we do not do it. And so it's very like hyper focus on performance marketing, SEO, ads, and all of that data is starting to slip away. Now, those are still really good practices, but to your point, like, we're not getting what we used to get from it. We are getting data, you know, out of our customer base. There's no doubt about it. Acquisition, like net new acquisition, is getting about to and is already getting much, much harder than it ever was. And so, like with most things, when, you know, one channel goes down, another one will rise up. And so as net new acquisition gets more challenging, marketing to your existing customers, to the audiences that you know, that are known to you and that have opted to be known to you, that becomes not only easier, but more important. And so I think that's one of the fundamental shifts that's happening right now in marketing, is like, you see all these companies like shifting their focus to cultivating a known audience and then putting most of their effort into, you know, expansion in the customer base, leveraging the networks of their existing customers, you know, building advocates out of them. So that has changed a lot from this fixation on new logos, new leads, new contacts into the, you know, growing the pie. I also think this is going to create kind of a new era of some more experimentation in, you know, in brand storytelling, and like a little bit more, because we can't measure it, there'll be more room for like, all right, well, let's try it, like, and see what happens. And so I think like, it's nice to see us go, we kind of went to this place, we swung the pendulum too far to where it was like, we only do the stuff we can optimize. And now I think there's a nice swing back to, we're going to be okay with some marketing that is harder to measure, and go on like gut and feedback and kind of what we feel like is right for the business.
Have you seen anybody doing the gut feedback, risk-taking stuff really well? Or is there anything that you have your eyes and ears tuned into that you think that others should?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, I look to like, you know, anyone doing interesting marketing today is probably going on gut for a lot of it. So like bookshop.org, right? They're an alternative to Amazon, right? So they've set up, you know, their enemy, they're a challenger brand. Their enemy is Amazon, buying books through Amazon, because it's bad for authors, it's bad for booksellers, in their perspective. And so they've set up a place where you can buy books online, which is what everybody likes about Amazon.
Yeah.
But that those dollars get back to the local bookstores, or a portion of them get back to the local bookstores in your community. Okay. Came out of the pandemic, right?
Okay.
And as a way to save local bookstores, and then kind of grew. They don't have the kind of like, they're not advertising. They're beyond like the book pages themselves. They're not doing SEO. They have like a really like savvy social tone, and they have really good relationships with partners and with their community, and that has fueled their growth over the last few years. So you can go to like their, you know, they were one of the first brands I saw on Threads, and their tone on Threads is really good. They have a fan base that, you know, contributes content to them. They have managed to get to a place through partnerships where, like, the New York Times, now when they talk about a book, will give you a link to Amazon and will give you a link to Bookshop.
That's crazy. Yeah.
And, like, that's how the business is going to grow, right?
Yeah.
But that's not, none of that is measurable. Even, like, the, you know, getting your links on New York Times, on, like, all the media publications, on the publishing houses, that's all, like, hard-won relationship stuff that can, that you can't report on that on a monthly basis. But they're doing well, right? And so I think that's a good example of, you know, a consumer brand that sort of leaned into that. You got to give Canva props for the, like, the onstage enterprise security rap heard around the world.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's...
I was just watching that this morning.
That was, like, absurd and, you know, had nothing to do... Like, no way of measuring if that bet... That was a big bet. And yeah. No way of measuring if that was going to take off, or if it was going to, you know, sink. And the reality is, like, at the end of the day, it did both. And that was okay, right? Like, they had 84 million impressions of that video in the months after they, you know, launched it. And so, like, things like that where there's just, like, we're going to go on gut feel that we can pull this off in a way that is self- aware and funny and enjoyable and, you know, just skate that cringe line, right? People would argue how well they did that or not, but, like, they decided they could take that bet. So I think those kind of examples are what I look to see, like, okay, where are the fun places that marketing could go if we release the need to measure everything?
Yeah, I just think it's really cool to hear you talk about those. I mean, especially the Bookshop example, because I hadn't heard of that one. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the fact that we're talking about it is a sign that it's working. So, like, it's obviously resonated with you deeply enough to get you to talk about it on a podcast. But I also think it's just interesting because it is a big pendulum swing, right? Like, pre-internet, we had no data at all, really. You had, like, brand surveys and you had sales data. And a lot of brand marketing takes a while to kick up. Like, someone has to know your brand. You have to stand for something. It has to resonate. And then once it eventually resonates, you're seeing it perform. But it could take time. And so there was clearly this, like, unbelievable skill and approach that was built up by industries that were never online. Go online, everything gets perfect data. Almost like it's kind of like some of that magic or that skill, that science was lost.
Yeah.
And now we have to refine it again. And figure out how to balance it also with the fact that, like, if you're selling stuff online, bookshop.org, good example, people are still buying the books. They can see how people hit the page and sign up and convert. And, like, they actually should be optimizing a lot of things. And there should be a lot of performance in there. It's just this, how do you balance the two is an interesting, I think, thing for all of us to be thinking about right now.
I also think, just to add on to that, like, the ways that we go about trying to, like, measure brand, I think, are really flawed. Like, we do these, you know, overarching, like, brand awareness surveys and sentiment analysis, and they're so far removed. And they move by, like, a percentage point.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying to, like, measure brand stuff on that. When I think it should be much closer to, like, hey, this customer that came in, did they engage with that campaign? Or, you know.
I hear you on that so much. Like, it's funny. We've done a bunch of brand surveys and we've had numbers move. But then it's like, well, we've had, in some cases, numbers move a lot. But then the critique is, like, these surveys are really for B2C. We're not really at the scale at B2B to know how significant the data is. And I find myself going to the exact same thing that you're saying, which is literally talk to the customers who are signing up and be like, did you hear about this? Did you notice this? Like, where'd you hear about us? Like, a very simple question. Like, do you know? And if you do, that might matter a lot because most people are not going to tell us. But it's, again, it's very hard. I find it so interesting because, like, on the product side, at least for us, like, the customer insight and the customer research has become religion, you know? Yeah. So it's like, we have all the data, but they are constantly showing things to customers. They are constantly interviewing them. There's these huge blocks of text of like, this is exactly what they like, this is what they don't like. I was like, oh God, this changes everything about what we're gonna do next. It's this like loop. And then on the marketing, go-to-market side, we basically have the same data and it's not treated the same way. Yeah. And it's very, I find it very odd. And I think it's like the only thing that I mean, we're trying to evolve. And that's kind of why I asked the question in the first place, is it's like this balance, right? Yeah. Is like hard to get right, even from, I think, like a personality perspective.
Yeah.
Like I think some people's personalities gravitate towards each of these approaches.
Totally.
And disentangling that is also an interesting like opportunity and challenge.
Although it's funny, like I've seen, now I've been in this industry for a couple decades, I've seen people who like used to argue vehemently against doing unmeasurable stuff are now like, you know, search is kind of done. Maybe we should do like this flash mob, you know, like, I don't know.
Totally.
But, like, they're advocating for it now too. So I think that, you know, I think that marketing is just, it goes through phases and you make the best choices with the information and the avenues that you have in the moment. And sometimes when an avenue is broken or is going through some trouble, like performance marketing is right now, you know, it gives you some freedom to try to create new avenues into the company.
Let's talk a little bit about storytelling. So how do you think about storytelling, how important it is for brands today? I mean, obviously you're doing a lot of things where you can't measure them potentially. Like, what are the ways that people should be thinking about that? And how are you thinking about that with Watershed?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no use in building the biggest audience in the world if you don't know what you want to say to them at the end of the day. I think it's fundamental to get the core parts of your house together around your message, right? Like, what is it that you stand for? Who are you fighting for? What are you fighting against? Those things should be really clear and held by everybody in your company. And then I think there are parts of storytelling that need to reflect the moment that they're in. So if you take those same values that you started with and you put it in today's environment versus a, you know, 2020 COVID era environment versus whatever the heck is going to be the environment in, you know, 2 years, aspects of how you tell that story need to shift. And then I also think competitively, as you change, your story needs to evolve. So a lot of companies will start off as what's known as like a challenger brand, where there's a dominant player in the market. HubSpot did this with Salesforce, right? Like, dominant player in the market, and a big piece of your story has got to be about unseating that dominant player. But then fast forward a few years, and if you're successful, like, suddenly you're the dominant player and you can't play the challenger brand anymore. You've got to find a new way to evolve that story without losing the heart of those values that kind of made up the architecture of it to begin with. So I think it's a science and an art, and I think it is essential from a navigational standpoint in the company to make sure you're like making the right calls and building a brand people can stand behind.
Aggressive nodding is happening for those who are just listening.
I mean, I think what you're saying is, if you don't have a story that stands for something and against something, like, you, it's not going to work. And being really clear about where you are in the journey, I think, is really important. Like, it's, you can get out of touch. Like, the story you're telling can get out of touch, to your point, the HubSpot thing. If they're like only talking about the challenger being Salesforce, like, I think they might have more CRM customers now than Salesforce does. I think I just saw that.
Possibly.
And so it just won't resonate the same way that it used to. And so it's figuring out how to like evolve that positioning and evolve that storytelling, but still figure out what you're for and what you're against, is your point.
Yeah.
And that context changes the story.
Yeah.
You really artfully, I think, helped define the product marketing at HubSpot and figured out what stories to tell, and also, you know, how to enable the teams to tell the story, to each, everybody tell their story in the right way and the wrong way. And I just think for product marketing is something that a lot of startups don't start with. They don't know that they need it because it's often like a shared responsibility, and then it gets defined and then it becomes like extremely, extremely important. What advice would you give for somebody who is looking at their business, realizing, huh, I think I might need this. Like, I think we're at the moment that we should be building out product marketing. Like, what should they own? What should they do? Yeah. Like, what should you ask of product marketing if you're kind of establishing it for the first time?
Yeah. I do think that product marketing looks different at different companies by necessity, right? Like, different companies need different things out of product marketing. I think that the thing that is universal to all product marketing teams is the role that it plays in building out the way that you talk about your products as a collection, right? So building the architecture of this is, you know, what this thing is, this is why it matters, this is why it is unique in the field and differentiated from how everybody else does it. And, you know, these are the kind of proof points against that. I think there's that stuff is should be done early as a company, because it also helps inform, like, when you can talk about something in a consistent way, it will show you where the like anomalies are, and it will show you where you need to sand down your product vision, and it will inform direction, right? So if you're trying to decide, yeah, do we go over here? Do we expand into this vertical? I think a big test of whether or not you should do that is how well can you tell that story, you know, in a congruent way with your existing product portfolio. So I would invest in it really early, because I think it gives the company, even internally, just a handhold to be able to understand what you're building, right? And to be able to put voice to it. That then translates into sales, that translates into what customers expect from you. And so I think that's fundamental to all product marketing. Then I think there are additional like bents that product marketing can take that will depend on what your company needs from a go-to-market standpoint. So there are product marketing teams that are really hyper launch focused. These are for like, you know, they're really focused on big announcements, net new logos, getting people into the top of the funnel, like making noise. If you're going to be shipping a lot, like making moments out of that for the sake of bringing new people into the company. There are other product marketers that are more focused on like, hey, we have no problem at the top of the funnel. What our problem is that our, you know, our funnel is breaking down in the sales process, and we're losing to competitors. Our close rates are abysmal. And like in that world, your product marketer is much more focused on sales enablement, objection handling, like market research, pricing and packaging, trying to find a way to smooth out, you know, that side. And so the strategically what you do, I think the mix looks different, but at the baseline, there has to be this, you know, translator for the company of why you made that product choice and, you know, how it's going to advance your customers.
So centralizing the research and opinions by product, by vertical, and helping people, like helping enabling people to make, to advocate for like what should resonate in the market, what we believe should resonate in the market. Is that another way of saying it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like, you know, your PM, your product manager will come up with, hey, this is what we think we want to launch this year. This is the direction we think we want to head the product in. Product marketing should play a role in figuring out like, all right, well, does that, that's a great hypothesis. Like, does that hold water in the market? When we talk to people about that idea, is that a real problem to be solved? So there's some amount of like market research that happens up front that then informs product direction. And then that same market research then expands to inform how do we message this thing and bring it to market. And then there is an examination post-launch of, did all those things prove true or did we miss something along the way? I remember like at HubSpot, and I've told this story before, so hopefully they don't care. Like we launched a CMS and early, I don't know, somewhere in the middle of my career there. And one of the features of the CMS was it could adapt. It had what we called smart content. It could like adapt based on who was looking at it. And we thought that that was like the innovation. Like that was the thing that we were all about, personalized marketing. Like it made a lot of sense. There was a ton of like excitement when we talked to people pre-market around that feature. Like they're like, oh, that's really interesting. I haven't seen that before. But we mistook, oh, that's really interesting. I haven't seen that before, for, oh my God, that's going to solve this problem that has been you know, painting me forever. And it was what we thought was, you know, the crux of our positioning was really a nice to have. And when we went to market, we realized that, like, actually people are really still struggling at getting a page online and like the technical complexity of managing a CMS. And we haven't gone far enough to address that with this release. So like those kind of calculations, I think, are the role that product marketing can play to make sure that this thing fits with the problems in the market and that it, you know, has a shot at succeeding with the customer base.
I love that example. Thank you for sharing that, because I feel like that's so, you can see that happening so easily.
Yeah.
It's like very tangible.
There's like 1,000 AI problems that are going after now. Like having falling down the same way.
Yeah, exactly. You do a thing, you think it's really cool. No one asked you to do it.
Yeah.
You go and tell them.
And they think it's really cool too. Yeah, like,
And then they think it's cool. This sounds really great. And they're like, oh, that doesn't really work because like this other really basic thing I need to do, this doesn't help you with at all.
Yeah. AI, when people like text to video first started coming out, people were like, oh my God, I can make a motion picture. Like I can like, just by describing it, it'll make this video. And then like you get into reality. And part of this was like the technology wasn't strong enough. But I think the bigger issue is the real problem is people didn't need to go from text to video. They needed to go from like video that they had shot to 1,000 different formats of that video, or they needed to like cut social pieces, or they like, so it, the problem was wrong.
Yes, exactly. I think about that all the time because there's certain applications of some of the like text video AI stuff that I think is cool. Like we use it for, we don't use it for anything that's, I'm talking about Wistia personally in our marketing. Yeah. We use it for animatics. So we use it to prove out a concept where we know the only people who are going to see it is us. And it is not representing our brand. It's got like crazy stuff in it, but it's faster often or more specific than like the stock footage that you would have to buy to like create the animatic.
Yeah.
But I think about that a lot. It's like looks really, really cool. But then it's like, okay, it's the same thing with like cloning yourself, the AI avatars. Mm-hmm. I think there's lots of promise there eventually on helping you in like re-editing. And there's a lot of people using it for like sales stuff or whatever. But the problem you have is if you like type something in and it spits out an answer, but the intonation isn't right.
Yeah.
Which is like, as a human being, like we're very used to figuring that out. And it's like, now try to instruct an AI to get the intonation right. Like it is, you end up spending more time doing that. There's a lot of stuff. Like, I mean, we could go on and on about AI over promising. There's this thing called Autopod. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
It's like you take a podcast like this and it automatically edits it for you. So it focuses on who it thinks she's talking and who should be on camera or whatever. And I'm really blowing up their spot. I'm sorry, guys. But we try to hear if we're talking too loud. And we're using it for a while. But what ended up happening was our editor who's dealing with this would spend so much time correcting it to get it right.
Yeah.
That he eventually was like, it's not worth doing this. Like, I'm just going to do it the way I know how. Because the corrections on the AI edit took longer than just editing it straight through. And I think it's like, this is the challenge with a lot of this stuff is like, how do you find the thing that actually delivers and is actually useful? And is it the core use thing that someone's trying to do or not? And I think that's where we've seen so much AI stuff that's like popped and fizzled.
And some of that is a technology limitation and you know it will get there, right? Where it's like, hey, this is actually the right problem to solve and kind of the right approach to solve it. It's just not good enough yet. That's one problem. But I think what's more commonly happening is even if Autopod or like that technology were great and perfect, even if text to video, if Runway came out and it was like perfect on day one, is that the right problem to solve with this technology? And is that where we need the focus? That's, I think, where people go really wrong. It's like, what is it? You know? Yeah. So,
well, just because you can doesn't mean you should, like, right? Like it's, and I think there's a lot of, it's the thing that's interesting about like a lot of the AI, Gen AI stuff, I think is like the speed with which you can make it. So the barrier to creating the thing can become so low that we just see way more of it not working. Yeah. Whereas like when the barrier was much higher before, we saw less stuff in this vein. It's almost like you have to train yourself. And I still play around with Gen AI stuff like basically every day.
Oh yeah. I'm a fan.
Constantly trying stuff to be like, does this deliver? Does this deliver? And there are things every once in a while that are really incredible, but it is when they are, you know, it's like, it's the whole thing of like when it's deeply integrated into the right product you already use in the right way, then it's like, okay, the core thing you're trying to do is still the same core thing. And now you have the superpower and that's amazing, but not everything is like that.
I have one more example for you from the world. Now that we're just knocking on companies, I won't name them, but there's a company I saw that will help sales reps make personalized videos. So you make one video and then you just like give it a list of names and it'll start the video with like, "Hi, Chris, this is Megan. Good to see you." And here's what struck me about that.
Sorry, just kidding.
It sucks. So here's the thing. The problem that it is trying to address is that it wants to bring more personalization into sales emails, which have been, like, that's why you put someone's name in it. That's why you do a personalized video. But then the solution is you're not personalizing at all. You're just, like, automating the thing that you were trying to personalize. So it's, like, counter to what the point was, which is I care enough about this deal that I'm taking time to record you a one-to-one video. And what's going to happen is it's the exact same thing as when we started to be able to like insert first name into emails.
Yeah.
It's going to break. It's going to erode trust. People aren't going to be going to like trust that as a vehicle. And then the whole thing will like not be useful. Right.
Yeah. It works at the very beginning. And then it stops performing really well because everyone's doing it. And then ultimately, the trust is eroded and you have to go back to doing other things, actually personalizing or actually having people involved or whatever the thing is.
Yeah. Marketing is full of these like scorched earth practices where it's like it works really well for the first couple of months and then everybody does it. And then the strings reveal themselves and then that's burnt out and you have to move to the next thing.
Here's a question for you on that, which is, I 100% agree with you. I feel like I've seen that many times. You've seen it many times. Do you think people should still try to do it? Or do you think they should assume it's going to stop working? Like, how should you balance that type of opportunity?
Yeah, I think you should do it if it uniquely fits the problem you're trying to solve and the audience and your skill set, right? Like, I think if you're doing it because it worked for them, you're going to fail at it. So a better example than this is like, podcasts, right? Like everybody jumped on board to make a podcast because it was starting to be a new channel, it's starting to break through. Like I think that it was right for everybody to like see that as an opportunity, but you have to figure out what unique thing are you bringing to that opportunity and how are you going to be successful at it? It's not, you can't just expect to get into the vehicle and have it work, right? And so that's where it's like, you have to make a judgment call. There's like so many examples of that over the course of history that like, you know, I keep trying to like give you examples. I'm like, oh, but I don't want to piss that person off. And like, I want to like be mean because I've done stuff like this too, where it's like, you know, I've tried something because others have done it and it's worked for them.
This is,
I don't knock that desire. Like that's curiosity.
Yeah. And I've made that mistake too. And I think it's interesting because like the lesson you learn is that just because you see someone doing something doesn't mean that it works.
Yeah.
For you. Doesn't mean that it works for you.
Well, it doesn't mean it works for, doesn't mean it works for them. Like,
that's true,
I feel like there's been times I've seen other companies like, oh, wow, they're doing this. This is so interesting. Like, maybe we should do this. And then just like, no, they were doing a test. They didn't know if it worked yet either. So it would be a mistake to copy them. And then also, if it doesn't fit into your strategy in a way that it feels supernatural,
Then
I think it is like, you know, then there's constant friction and constant questioning and all the things on the margins you need to do to make it work end up not being there, you know, like, and that's a hard lesson to learn. Cause I think it's like, you see someone doing something, it seems very easy and obvious. Oh, I should do this. Then you try to do it. If it doesn't fit with the strategy, it usually doesn't end up working out.
Yeah, totally.
Well, we're getting in there. We also are running low on time, so we're going to go to the rapid fire segment now.
Cool.
Okay. First question. What movie can you watch over and over again?
Die Hard 3.
Incredible.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
That was very quick.
That was, see?
Too quick.
I, Die Hard 3, I really have not seen that in a long time.
Specifically 3, yeah.
That's, yeah. Yeah, I got it. I just was thinking I need to watch Die Hard 1 again, but I should also watch 2 and 3.
Yeah.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
All right, so I have like the perfect range for like 90s rock music. So Weezer, same. Green Day,
yes.
Any kind nice. Of pop punk, like that's my safe space. So that's what I go to. And usually those are the ones that we've now reached a point where like everybody can sing along to those
because
now
amazing.
They're nostalgic, even the younger kids. So so that helps.
It's our time. Our time is now for 90s rock. What's the best book you've read this year?
I have read a lot of good books this year. I think actually the one that is right next to me right now is really good. There's this woman, Zadie Smith. She wrote this coming out of the pandemic called Intimations, rather. It's just a series of essays on that moment in time. And like, okay. I really love creative nonfiction. Like I love essayists. I love science writing. I'm really excited for Dr. Johnson's book, What If We Get It Right, coming out. So I'm drawn to those sorts of things that like
cool.
are based in reality, but take a creative bent to it.
Love that. Who's your brand crush at this moment and why?
Let's see. There are like aspects that I like of different brands. I don't think that any brand is doing it like perfectly across the top. But I mentioned them already. I think Canva takes really good, really like smart risks in their marketing. I think they're having a lot of like fun in their marketing, which any brand that feels like it's having fun right now after the last few years of just like drudgery, I'm immediately drawn to. There's a company called Rose, R-O-W. I think it's rose.com or rose.ai. They took a cool gamble where they replaced their homepage with just their product. Like basically, if you go to their site, it is as if you had just logged into the product. There's no messaging on it.
Oh, wow.
They basically gave up on SEO for the homepage. And they just said, we're just going to let people experience the product. And, you know, at a certain point, you log in, you create an account. But they kind of killed the website in favor of a product interface. And I think that took some guts. And,
that's cool.
I've kind of heard that that's worked out well for them. I also really like companies that have kind of reinvented themselves over a period of time. Like, I think that, you know, there are some big companies that, you know, should be doing well because they have big budgets. But like, I think that Google's done a nice job recently of like trying to surf this narrative around AI, and they took some knocks and they came back from it and they sort of like found their place in it. So I look to them for, I've always looked to them for product videos. I think their product videos are like beautiful. So yeah, I pick and choose, and then I put together like a little transformer brand that
love it
that I like the most.
If you weren't a marketer, what would you be?
Speechwriter.
Speechwriter, hell yeah.
Yeah,
love it.
That was the original ambition, but there's not that many of them in the world.
Really?
And, well, I mean, it's like a small pool, but I would love to be a political speechwriter. Yeah, it's just like a fun. It's a fun style of writing that has its own rules. And so it's fun to, you know, I would never be bored. That again, you're trying to take these really complex ideas and bring them down to a place where they can be universally resonant and have a life of their own after the speech, right? Like that's a unique challenge.
That's hard. Yeah. But it's cool. And I can actually see the connection to what we're talking about before in terms of telling the story and how you market it and simplify and all that stuff. Megan, it was so good to see you. Thank you for coming on the show. Where can people connect with you to learn more?
Yeah. So I used to say Twitter, and now I'm not on Twitter anymore as much. So I would say LinkedIn. I guess we've moved the party over there. You can also check out Watershed at watershed.com. And we are going to be, I'm going to be in Climate Week coming up in New York, which will be a lot of fun. So you can find me there.
Awesome. Well, good to see you. This is fun. And best of luck.
Thanks so much.
There was so much in there, so much in that interview. Like, started with climate tech, zoomed out to like, what happens when you have to market sort of a new tone or a new idea. Talked about storytelling, product marketing. Like, I think there were a lot of takeaways in there.
Yes, I think so. And I mean, Megan is awesome. And she's seen so much of this at different scales and startups and at like wildly successful companies like HubSpot. And she's just really good at communicating things and breaking them down. So it was like, I'm not surprised that we ended up with an episode that had like lots of takeaways, but I imagine if you're thinking about marketing in today's world, you probably took some notes in there. And I definitely encourage you to also ask her questions. She's very, historically, she was very active on Twitter. She's also very active on LinkedIn. And she's just really generous with her time. And so, yeah, it was really great to see her. Great to have her on the show. Great to chat all about all that stuff. And cool, I think, also to see what translates between her experience in SaaS and AI to climate. Because, like, it, in one sense, it's very, very different. In the other sense, it's extremely similar.
Yeah. I mean, there are things that definitely seem unique to this space that she's navigating now, but like some very fundamental things about marketing that will always be true no matter the industry that you're in. So,
yes, totally.
Marketers everywhere, no matter the industry, should take a listen or take a watch. Take a watch.
They should watch. You know what? If you're watching this at the end, thanks. And if you're not, just take this clip. This is going to be a great episode. You're going to love it. And share with somebody else who would find it interesting.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, that's it. That's this week's episode of Talking Too Loud. We'll be back with more episodes in the next couple weeks. And of course, please don't forget to rate and review the show wherever you consume it. Rating the show, reviewing the show really helps us out, helps more people discover it. Please let us know where you're watching it. Comment if you like it on the platform you're on. That's very helpful. And of course, if you have feedback, guests you think we should have it on, email us at ttlpod@wistia.com. We'll see you soon.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.